It's Thursday, December 19, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Do journalists lean left? At least some of them recently admitted so. Dylan Byers, writing for Politico, tells us that top journalists from the New York Times, NBC News, and CNN acknowledged Wednesday of this week that, generally speaking, the national media has a liberal bias. On a Playbook breakfast panel, he reports, The Times' Peter Baker and Mark Leibovich, NBC's Kelly O'Donnell, and CNN's Jake Tapper all said yes. The question was if the news media lean left, although he says all agreed it was a nuanced issue, having more to do with journalists' life experience than with any particular agenda. As you might expect, this just gets more interesting. Mark Leibovich of the New York Times said this, quote, most of my colleagues, I have no idea what their politics are, but think about it. I live in Northwest Washington. None of my neighbors are evangelical Christians. I don't know a lot of people in my kids' preschool who are pro-life. He went on to say, when you have conversations at all the newspapers I've worked at about politics, it doesn't happen often, but you see clues that there is absolutely a left-wing bias, end quote. Well, it's an amazingly honest statement, perhaps more candid an admission of what he doesn't hear than what he does think. Byers goes on to report that Jake Tapper, the CNN host and former ABC News White House correspondent, said that the bias was, in his words, quote, much more complicated and complex than reducing it to the issues of liberal or conservative. He went on to say this, quote, a certain type of person becomes a reporter. Generally speaking, I'm not saying every reporter in the world, the kind of person who is a reporter in Washington, D.C. or New York City, has never worked at a minimum wage job outside of high school, has never experienced poverty, is not an evangelical Christian. Like much of the country is, Tapper went on to say, there are a lot of experiences that the kinds of people who are reporters, editors, producers in Washington and New York City have not had, end quote. Well, that's, to be honest, the kind of candor most of us haven't heard from journalists involved in just this kind of work, looking at themselves, considering what they see and what they don't see, what they hear and what they don't hear. There's an interesting argument that's being made here. As a matter of fact, a couple of very interesting arguments. One of them is that the issue can't be reduced simply to liberal and conservative. There's truth in that. Most issues can't be reduced to anything quite that simplistic. On the other hand, there is a great cultural divide in this country, an ideological, philosophical worldview divide, a moral divide. And as scholars such as Thomas Sowell have pointed out, there is a predictable progression in terms of where people line up. The pattern is very clear. There is a left and there is a right. Conservative and liberal are too simplistic, yes, but they are labels that make sense, as even these journalists allow. When they say, yes, it's true, the journalistic community leans left. The other interesting thing to observe is that these journalists, looking at their own craft and at their own tribe, say that the big issue here isn't political bias, but life experience. Now, from a worldview perspective, Christians looking at that kind of statement should recognize there's an enormous amount of truth in that. You look at the fact that life experience and this kind of perspective are actually inseparable. Which is why we have to remember that we are not disembodied minds. We are people who have experiences and ideas. We have intuitions and theories. We operate out of a worldview that is indeed tied to our life experience, which also reminds us that one of the problems in terms of the national media, certainly the leading media, the CNN, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribunes, and Wall Street Journals of the world, is that those who do write and edit those very influential periodicals, newspapers, and news outlets usually don't have the same kind of experiences as the people that they expect to watch their programming and read their articles and be convinced by their editorial coverage. There's something else to observe here as well. Our experiences aren't accidents. They don't just happen to us. We choose our experiences. And those who tend to be employed by and very active in the elite media in this country are those whose experiences would be predictably those that would prepare them for this kind of job and would make those who hire such journalists and editors interested in their resume. So we're not talking here about an accident. We're talking about a self-selected group that tends, like every other tribe, to select out of their own self-referential kind of people. And those people have the same kind of predictable experiences. And those people who have the same experiences oftentimes represent the same worldview as well, and a part of that worldview is a political and moral bias. At least two of the participants in that panel represented the New York Times. A very important article by Terry Mattingly, published at Pathos, tells us that the New York Times itself became a prime example of this very syndrome the very week that this took place. Mattingly writes an article entitled The Latest Coverage from the Church of the New York Times. He goes to Baptist Press, not the New York Times, but the press service of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that denominational wire service's coverage of the recent court case, the federal court case in Utah, having to do with polygamy. And he goes to the coverage by Baptist Press and finds that predictably it cited, well, you anticipated this, Baptists. And not only that, but moral and cultural theological conservatives, the kind of people whom Baptist Press would be expected to turn to for analysis of this kind of situation. Dr. Russell Moore, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the SBC, was cited in the article, and so was I. But we weren't alone. Jonathan Turley, who was the attorney for the plaintiffs in this case, the man arguing for the legalization of polygamy, he was also cited in the Baptist Press news story. Responding to that, Terry Mattingly, himself a veteran journalist, writes, "Bravo." He says that it gladdens his heart to see hints of intellectual and cultural diversity, even in copy from a denominational wire service. So far, so good. Why bring this up, he asks? He answers, well, in this case, it is interesting to contrast the Baptist Press piece with the coverage of the same decision that was offered in, you anticipated this, the New York Times. Mattingly goes to the New York Times coverage of the decision, and then he writes this. The Times team does not quote any voices on the cultural right. They quoted those, in other words, only on the cultural left, in response to this decision. The material is framed by the judge, the Times, and Turley, that's Jonathan Turley, the attorney, alone. Mattingly then writes, it would appear that the content of the New York Times story is, to be blunt, framed in a way that suggests classic advocacy journalism, in this case to a degree that is just as strong, if not stronger, than the Baptist Press story. So, Mattingly then asks this question. Why would the great gray lady, that's the New York Times, use the same journalistic approach as a denominational wire service such as Baptist Press? He then goes on to ask in conclusion, if the Times editors are framing their coverage in accordance with a set of doctrines, what is the name of the church that determines the advocacy approach used in this case? He puts the word church in scare quotes. The bottom line, has the Times, on moral and cultural issues, evolved into a denominational news source? End quote. The answer to Terry Mattingly's question is yes. This is not a unique indictment of the New York Times. It is a realization, and this is very important from a Christian worldview perspective and an intellectual responsibility perspective, to recognize that every news source, every reporter, every editor has a viewpoint. That viewpoint might not come down to something as easily described in the negative as bias, but there is no such thing as viewpoint neutrality. And these articles make very clear, there certainly is no pretension to neutrality, at least in terms of the actual reporting that ends up in a newspaper even as illustrious and influential as the most influential newspaper in the United States of America, the New York Times. Oh, and by the way, while people are complaining about the New York Times, the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky decided to get in line. In an article that appeared Tuesday in the Courier Journal, that's Tuesday of this week, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher complained about the fact that the New York Times, in describing the plans of outgoing New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg to deal with improvements in cities, that the effect of Bloomberg's mission was going to extend even to far-flung places such as Louisville. Governor Fisher responded, Louisville is not far-flung. He went on to say, quote, maybe if you're in New York and looking at Louisville, it is far-flung, end quote. In other words, he says, Louisville isn't far-flung, not unless you are a reporter for the New York Times and you actually don't get out to the rest of the country. Some of those in the cultural elites, especially on both coasts, refer to the center of the country, that is the vast heartland of this country, as flyover country, because that's how they see it. They fly over it. And if you fly over it, evidently it looks far-flung, but not to the mayor of Louisville, who says Louisville is not far-flung. And now you know. Well, as the year comes to an end, it's good for us to be reminded of the absence of worldview neutrality in the media. But we also need to be reminded of the absence of the very same reality, worldview neutrality in academia. And if journalism is leaning left, well, to coin an expression, academia may be leaning lefter. It is an even more ideologically stratified and polarized, not to mention outbalanced, sector of our culture. New evidence of that comes from an action this week when an American organization of professors known as the American Studies Association, by the way, they only have about 5,000 members, but they're quite influential in the Liberal Academy, they announced that their members had voted by about a 2-to-1 margin to affirm a boycott of Israeli academic institutions. As the New York Times reports, this is to protest Israel's treatment of Palestinians, signaling that a movement to isolate and pressure Israel that is gaining ground in Europe has begun to make strides in the United States. The American Studies Association is one of those academic societies often referred to as guilds. It is a society of scholars who are supposedly in the same discipline. But this is one of the least defined disciplines in the modern academy. But if anything defines it, it is a leftward direction, as this story makes very, very clear. It does have fewer than 5,000 members, but as the Times says, its vote is a milestone for a Palestinian movement known as BDS for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, which the Times says, for the past decade, has found little traction in the United States. The ASA, the American Studies Association, now becomes the second American academic group behind the AAAS, otherwise known as the Association for Asian American Studies. That group decided to take the same vote for the same action back in April. There are several things to note in this development. One of them is that Europe has been trending in an openly anti-Semitic direction, certainly an anti-Israeli direction, but it can only now be defined as an anti-Semitic direction for about the last 10 to 15 years. This kind of action has become rather routine in universities and academic circles, leftist political circles in Europe. This kind of movement hasn't gained much ground in the United States until now, but now it is, at least with these two professional societies, and they have announced they intend to take their mission elsewhere. Responding to this, Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador to the United States, said, quote, rather than standing up for academic freedom and human rights by boycotting countries where professors are imprisoned for their views, the ASA chooses as its first ever boycott to boycott Israel, the sole democracy in the Middle East, in which academics are free to say what they want, write what they want, and research what they want, end quote. This gets to the basic hypocrisy of this particular action. If, indeed, the American Studies Association was going to go after repressive regimes, it couldn't possibly start with Israel. That means there is some political reason why they took the action of starting with Israel, starting with a democracy, starting with a country that, by the way, has actually done more for the Palestinians than the Arab-governed countries in the same region. What we're looking at here is the fact that something other than a dispassionate academic consideration is clearly at work here. And that something else is a leftist bias, but it's not just a leftist bias. As we have seen in Europe, it is a creeping anti-Semitism, disguised as an anti-Israel perspective. But in this case, since Israel is a Jewish state and these issues are thus defined, this is a form of anti-Semitism, even as in the very resolution the group stated, believe us when we say we're not anti-Semitic. We stand against anti-Semitism, but we're going to take this action against Israel, even as the group has taken no action about Iran, about China, about any number of countries where professors disappear in the night, are assassinated, or imprisoned for thought crimes. Writing an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, Jonathan Marks, a professor at Ursinus College, said, with American colleges and universities imperiled by a bad economy, declining enrollment, and persistently high costs, a group of scholars gathered last month in Washington, D.C. to discuss the crisis. No, not that crisis. I mean the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. That's right. The most talked about question, and this is a really profound statement, the most talked about question at the annual meeting of the American Studies Association was a resolution to boycott Israel. In other words, why in the world are universities, I would say here, paying for faculty members to go to this kind of academic meeting? They're not talking about their discipline. They were talking about politics, and in this case, embarrassingly anti-Semitic politics. Back to Mark's article, he says, after the meeting, the ASA's National Council voted unanimously to endorse a boycott resolution and send it to the full membership for a vote. On Monday, the ASA announced that 66% of its members voted in favor of the boycott. The remainder of Mark's article, by the way, is an example of the kind of academic bullying that often goes on with the academic left. He gives example after example of how the members of this society were not even allowed to have a dissenting voice presented to them as they were making this vote. This is the very kind of pseudo-academic endeavor that was characteristic of Stalinism and the Stalinist era in the Soviet Union. Now it has arrived in this new form in the United States, but it's actually in many ways an old form because we've seen this thing before going all the way back to the 1960s. In its own editorial, the Wall Street Journal declared, it's still worth pondering what must go through the mind of a professoriate presumably dedicated to free political speech that would choose to boycott the most democratic country in the Middle East, the country in which Arabs are treated far better and have more rights than they do in most Arab lands, and the country that is America's most reliable ally. We can only imagine what these same professors must teach their students about the supposed crimes of America. Well, my response to the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal is, you don't have to guess. All you have to do is go into your local university bookstore and find out what they're writing. And what they're writing in books, you can count on this, is matched by something far more strident in class. Turning to issues related to Christmas, great issues of worldview significance also tend to arise at this time of the year, and inevitably so, given what's at stake in the Christmas celebration. Paul H. Tice, writing in the Houses of Worship column at the Wall Street Journal. By the way, he works in an investment management firm in New Jersey. He writes that the Christmas pageant in public schools and in many elite private schools have become, to use his description, a Gap Kids ad. He writes, "'Tis the season for the war on Christmas stories, with widely reported fights over the placement of manger scenes on public property and legal wrangling over other aspects of the national holiday that dares not speak its name. Less attention will be paid to one of the war's major casualties, what used to be known as the school Christmas concert. Parents, he writes, are all too familiar with the silencing of Silent Night." He goes on to write, "Over the past 20 years, as my children have progressed through the local New Jersey public school system, my wife and I have attended our share of such concerts. We've watched as these performances have slowly declined, arriving at the current phase, denial. It has now been several years since the word Christmas has even been spoken, let alone sung, at any of these school events." In this piece, Tice goes on to explain that this has been a progressive issue, and it has been in some ways rather seductive. In other words, you didn't notice it month by month, even year by year. You didn't notice it concert by concert. But over a period of time, and he's talking about a 20-year period here, he has seen the decline, and he's not in denial. He says Christmas has simply disappeared. You'll recall that he just described it as the holiday that dare not speak its name, referring to a famous cultural reference to homosexuality in the mid-20th century as the love that dare not speak its name. Well, now you can talk about homosexuality in the schools, but you can't talk about Christmas, and you certainly can't sing a Christmas carol. That's absolutely verboten. It's unconstitutional, say the schools, so many schools, intimidated by secularists. But, of course, what we're looking at here is the inexorable process of secularization, as a secular worldview begins to replace a Christian worldview. But in between the Christian worldview and the secular worldview is a secularizing worldview, a worldview that still has a Christian memory and isn't offended by singing Christmas carols. That gives way to a truly secularist worldview in which people are immediately ready to register their protest if you mention anything that might even refer to something that isn't religiously identified with Christmas. In other words, even some schools are afraid to let anyone mention Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. In case you haven't consulted Matthew or Luke lately, he's not in the Christmas story. Tice goes on to describe the progression whereby it goes from a Christmas concert to a winter concert to a solstice concert to eventually just a concert. And at this concert, you can do many things, but you can't reference the fact that there is even a Christmas holiday that is being celebrated by the vast majority of people in the room. And, of course, being celebrated, commercially so, at every shopping mall and at every public square you can imagine. He goes on to write, "One memorable grade school performance my wife and I attended 6 years ago included songs about dancing penguins and prancing polar bears sung by fifth graders dressed in white polo shirts and beige pants." Oh, by the way, I'm interrupting him here to say, "One of the things labeled as illegal, unconstitutional, harmful to humanity, and dangerous to your diet is identifying anything, even by color, like red and green. That's making a Christian statement. You're violating the separation of church and state." So, these children are wary, to get back to Tice's essay, white shirts and beige pants. He goes on to describe these fifth graders dressed in white polo shirts and beige pants as interspersed with poetic student readings about snow and ice. He writes, prompting visions of isolation, hypothermia, and snow blindness. He then says this, "Imagine a Gap Kids commercial directed by Ingmar Bergman. Now," he says, "these once festive and joyous musical events have become monochromatic affairs, both visually and artistically, devoid of any seasonal context. At last year's high school concert," he said, "all the students' performers were dressed in black. Formal, yes, but also funereal. Moreover, school music directors these days, overburdened by litigation avoidance strategies, have committed the sin, if that word is still allowed, of not just erasing religion from these concerts, but of basically abandoning musicality altogether. This isn't the time for Christians to try to relaunch the war on Christmas and to try to address this by political and legal mechanisms here as we're getting ready to celebrate the birth of Christ Jesus. It is, however, a prompt for Christians to understand just what we're up against in terms of our responsibility in an increasingly secularizing age. When you have to avoid even wearing red and green at Christmas time to avoid making a theological statement, you can understand why the secular left is so absolutely petrified that someone might actually utter the name of Jesus. When we do so, dear Christians, we need to do so not in a spirit of anger and defensiveness, but in a spirit of Christmas, of gospel witness, and goodwill. In other words, even as we note the lack of so much content, and so much truth, and so much tradition, and so much joy, and as Tice writes, so much music from these concerts, we need to recognize that what's missing most of all is the hope that is within us. That hope that we want to share with others at Christmas. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I go into twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. Whether you're wearing red and green or beige and white, I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.